I'm Mike Hudak, Director of Public Lands Without Livestock and author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. Please see the book's website, westernturfwars.com, for information about the book. In my podcast, Politics Trump Science and Rangeland Management, I described how public lands ranchers use the political system to intimidate employees of the federal land management agencies into providing rancher-friendly management of grazing allotments. We also learned that such manipulated management often harms the landscape and wildlife. Although political intimidation is a proven method for ranchers to achieve their objectives, it is not the only form of pressure that they can bring to bear on government land managers. Social pressure can also be effective. Yes, it has some limitations. For instance, it's only effective in small towns and rural areas. But that covers many of the on-the-ground employees who make decisions about grazing management plans. And unlike the political tactic, social pressure can also be applied to environmental activists who live in rural localities. So let's look at the things that ranchers and their allies do to make life unpleasant for people who try to uphold environmental laws and government regulations. I'll begin with remarks that pertain to government employees. Renee Galliano-Pop was at various times in her career a range conservationist, a botanist, and a program manager who altogether worked 20 years in Arizona and New Mexico for the U.S. Forest Service before resigning in 1998. When I interviewed her for my book, Western Turf Wars, Galliano-Pop told me about an experience she had during her tenure as program manager for threatened and endangered species. Here's what she said. In the early 1990s, when I was T&E program manager, we gave an award to people in the region for doing award-worthy work for T&E species. One year, we unanimously decided to give it to a ranger from reserve on the Gila National Forest. Why did we do that for him? He didn't do anything special, but he had the most contentious timber sales. His children were being blacklisted in school. His wife couldn't go to the store. Forest Service people who live in these rural communities were being blacklisted there because they did what the law said. Yet this ranger went through with the protections for the spotted owl the way they were written. We took a lot of flack because some people didn't understand why we gave that award to him. Hey, putting your family through that just to implement the plain and simple rules, I think, is award-worthy. Unquote. In other words, Galliano-Pop is saying that the government system for managing our public lands has become so dysfunctional, so hazardous to the well-being of its employees and their families, that an employee who simply implements the law under ordinary circumstances is a worthy recipient of a merit award. Imagine if this government employee were a firefighter. Would he or she be a likely recipient of an achievement award for simply showing up to fight fires? Or suppose we were talking about the police or the FBI. Would such an employee be considered for an award for not engaging in illegal activities such as taking bribes or collaborating with criminals? I don't think so. What I do think is that there are some really big problems with how the federal land management agencies operate. Let's try to better understand the rancher-initiated social torment inflicted on government land managers and their families. And an excellent way to gain that understanding is by listening to such people speak about their personal experiences. One of those people is Bill Worf, whose long career with the Forest Service included positions as district ranger, forest supervisor, and regional supervisor. Beginning in 1951, Worf worked on a multi-year project to evaluate the management of livestock on the Uinta National Forest in Utah. Here's what Worf said to me. When we got down the road a little bit, figuratively speaking, and I began telling the permittees what the proper use information was showing, things got really tense. Our children weren't in school at the time, but it got pretty tough on my wife. She couldn't go to the grocery store in town to get groceries because nobody would wait on her. Everybody in town was either a permittee or closely related to one, and we ended up driving to Provo, Utah to do our shopping because she was ostracized in Heber City. We had some staunch friends that stood by us, but it got pretty rough there, and we were there 4 years. If we'd had older children that were in school, particularly in junior high and high school, that would have been terrible on them. We just had to suck it up and live with it. The first winter that I was there, livestock people stopped by the office all the time, all winter long. In fact, it was a problem a lot of the time. People would just stop in and want to chew the fat for a while. By the second year, they were beginning to see where we were headed with the range studies, and we had a winter without any interruptions in the office. But I belonged to the Lions Club there, and District Ranger Andy McConkie also belonged. The president of the National Wool Growers Association, Don Clyde, and the president of the National Cattlemen's Association, Levi Montgomery, were also in the same Lions Club. You know, it was a small town. We couldn't avoid contact with people, and things got pretty tough. Unquote. Despite the unpleasantries that Worf and his family experienced, I'm happy to report that he and his Forest Service superiors ultimately implemented a grazing management plan that was based on their range analysis and was not influenced by the local ranchers. Stocking levels were reduced by 2/3. We have now heard examples of how life became difficult for a couple government employees and their families. But unpleasant though these experiences were, they don't seem to have included violence. So let's listen to the words of a couple people whose lives were threatened. Don Oman, a former district ranger for the U.S. Forest Service in southern Idaho, angered ranchers in the fall of 1989 when he and his staff counted cows as they were being taken off the range for the winter. Of course, the Forest Service has the right to count the cows, and Oman had been tipped off that one rancher had overstocked his allotment. But the ranchers were greatly angered by Oman's actions. So angered, in fact, that as reported in a New York Times article, one of the ranchers, Winslow Whiteley, was quoted as stating, "Myself and every other one of the permit holders would cut his throat if we could get him alone," unquote. When I interviewed Oman in 2003, here's what he told me about the incident. That cattle count was the big last straw that caused them to get with officials and demand that I be moved. One permittee, old Winslow Whiteley, the fellow that threatened to cut my throat in the New York Times article, told the range deputy and the forest supervisor right in front of me, "We don't want Don fired necessarily. He's a nice enough guy. Just move him back to North Idaho where there's no grazing in that timber country, and then he won't be bothered by it," unquote. Oman then concluded to me, "So the answer to the heavy grazing problem and the resource destruction down here on the Sawtooth Forest was to get rid of people that were worried about it," unquote. Although Oman's Forest Service superiors attempted to move him off the district as the ranchers wanted, Oman filed and won a whistleblower complaint that allowed him to remain as district ranger for several more years. In my experience, though, it's much more common for land managers like Don Oman to accept the transfer and simply get on with their careers and their lives. Don Oman isn't the only government land manager I've heard about who's been threatened with violence by a rancher. Mike Sauber, an environmental activist from southern New Mexico, told me about an incident he witnessed in connection with an evaluation of the Diamond Bar allotment on the Gila National Forest during a severe drought in 1994. Rancher Kit Laney held the grazing permit on the allotment. Here's what Sauber said to me. "We ended up having a big 3-day meeting out on the ground the week of the Oklahoma City bombing. The neighboring permittees were there, as well as members of the Range Improvement Task Force from NMSU, officials from the governor's, congressmen's, and senators' offices, and Forest Service personnel from the Gila Forest, the regional office in Albuquerque, and staffers from Washington, D.C. office. Our experts were there as well. Dr. Bob Omart, our riparian expert, and Bill Worf, our uplands expert. I believe at least one lawyer who was helping us came out too, as well as Susan and I. It was during this meeting, after we had heard that some deranged person or persons had bombed a federal building, that Laney made the threat. 'If you come to move my cattle off, you're going to meet 100 people with guns. It's stupid, really stupid, but it's going to happen.'" After the 3 days out on the allotment, nobody was willing to say that the Diamond Bar allotment looked good, or that there was any place to put more than 100 head of cattle. But lo and behold, a few weeks later, a new decision came out of the Forest Service. Rather than 100 head being allowed on the Diamond Bar, there was a decision to allow 400 head there. Laney had 600 head on the ground at the time, and nobody ever talked about where those other 200 would be put, unquote. Unlike the cases of Don Oman and Bill Worf, this is an example where a threat of violence from a rancher appears to have succeeded in getting the Forest Service to provide him with management more to his liking. So far, I've spoken only about harassment and threats of violence by ranchers. But sometimes the violence is carried out, as it was in an incident involving Dave Kohler back in 1979 when he was working for the Bureau of Land Management in northern New Mexico. Here's what Kohler told me about the incident. "I remember one occasion while we were attempting to impound trespass livestock, when the situation really turned ugly, and our crew was threatened with assault and death. They were standing around the corral, pelting us with rocks. We were about 80 miles by road from Albuquerque, but had one law enforcement agent with us, which probably prevented more serious trouble. On the way out, the patriarch of the local villagers fired 4 shots at me from about 400 yards out while I was on horseback. Charges were filed with the U.S. attorney, and the old man and 3 sons were charged with aggravated assault on federal officers. The offenders were brought to trial and given probated sentences for 3 years," unquote. A pretty lenient sentence from the court, in my opinion. And although this incident occurred within a complex socio-political context that I'm sure contributed to the leniency of the sentence, Let us not forget that this episode could not have happened had ranching not been allowed on public lands. And prior to sentencing, Kohler told me that someone at the state office of the BLM said to him and his crew, "You boys just need tougher hides." Unquote. How can we expect government personnel such as Dave Kohler to do their jobs when they aren't strongly supported by the agencies for which they work? Of course, given the political pressure that ranchers apply to these agencies, as I described in another podcast, we should not be surprised that high officials tend to undercut people like Kohler. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, social pressure, unlike political pressure from ranchers, is not limited in its application to government agencies. Social pressure can also be applied to environmental activists who live in rural areas. And before concluding this podcast, I'll give you a few examples. Julian Hatch is a grassroots environmental activist who lives in southern Utah. He grew up in Utah, has Mormon ancestors who were ranchers, and he didn't intend to become an activist until his property fence was cut and trespass cattle devastated his garden. Hatch then complained at the local BLM office, where he learned that the cattle weren't even supposed to be on the adjacent public land at that time. Here's what Hatch told me resulted from his complaint to the BLM. They came out, they checked the fence, they said they saw that the fence had been cut, but they accused us, as environmentalists, of cutting our own fences. They then said, yes, there weren't supposed to be any cows out there on the public lands. And they did see three cows, but only three out of the 45 or 50 that I had seen, because they had taken 2 or 3 days to get there. They identified who the brand belonged to, informed the rancher, and told him who had reported it. The next week, when I came to town, the son of that rancher shot and killed my dog right in front of me. Shot it 6 times. Said, "This is what you get, environmentalist." Unquote. If you're familiar with the typical fictional cowboys of television and cinema, Hatch's story about a rancher killing his dog under these circumstances will seem a bit out of character. Compare the reality with the brave, benevolent, and law-abiding ranchers such as Roy Rogers, Hopalong Cassidy, and of course, Ben Cartwright from the Bonanza TV show of the 1960s. Unfortunately, Hatch's experience with real ranchers is not unique. Lynn Jacobs, in his book Waste of the West, wrote that in response to his ranching reform efforts in Arizona, a local stockman shot his dog, skinned it, and left the remains near his house. Other types of property damage have also been committed against environmental activists who have opposed the interests of ranchers. Patrick Deal and his partner, Tory Woodard, lived in Escalante, Utah, where in the late 1990s they opposed the construction of a new reservoir intended to irrigate fields of livestock feed. When I spoke with Deal in 2004, here's what he told me happened, soon after his opposition to the reservoir was reported in the Salt Lake Tribune. Tory has a share of water in the irrigation company that was proposing to build the reservoir. We had irrigation pipes with water in them on our property. And somebody came in, probably about 3 in the morning, in April after the article appeared, opened up the run of pipe from the riser, moved the pipes just enough so that the water would run into an excavation we dug for a building we were hoping to construct, and turned on the riser full blast. Consequently, the excavation was totally filled up with water, approximately 40,000 gallons. Water was still running out at 8 in the morning, and the water master happened to come by, or knew to come by, we don't know, and informed us that there was an open pipe. I'd say 200 gallons a minute coming out of it. So of course we immediately closed it, and soon thereafter the irrigation company sued Tory for having an open pipe. She was basically being sued for being vandalized. I just went into orbit when that happened. We fought it in court for the next year and a half. First, the irrigation company went to small claims court improperly. They were trying to collect a fine, and small claims courts do not consider fines by a private organization against its members. But the local judge found for the irrigation company. So we had to appeal to the district court, where the case should have been filed in the first place. And the district court judge told the irrigation company that it had to come before him if it wanted to try to collect the fine. By that time, the irrigation company had spent over $8,000 trying to collect a fine of $1,100, and we'd spent a little over $2,000. It was well worth it to us because they discovered that they couldn't crunch us, they couldn't beat us, they couldn't drive us out of town, which is what they'd done over the decades to people who'd come here and tried to stand up to them. Anyway, the situation became one of profound hostility between the town and us. The following July, our house was attacked and the front door was kicked in. Windows were smashed. They cut the phone lines, tore up part of our garden. That was on Pioneer Day, the big Mormon celebration here in Utah. The vandalism continued off and on up till last summer. Smashed windows on our cars, one slashed tire, threats, I had a death threat at a meeting in spring of 99 during all this hullabaloo. Unquote. The examples I've cited throughout this podcast demonstrate the vulnerability of environmental activists and government employees to harassment and violence at the hands of ranchers. When ranchers combine these tactics with the pressure they can exert through their elected officials, we should not be surprised that the federal agencies deliver grazing management that is so favorable to ranchers that it coincidentally harms the landscape and wildlife. I do not see how the social harassment that I've spoken about can end as long as ranching continues on public lands and there remain people of conscience who observe the harm that ranching inflicts on these lands. If we want these lands covered with healthy native vegetation and populated with abundant wildlife, we should stop wasting time calling for better management and instead focus our attention on shutting down the ranching.